Today, when we think about Ramayan, Mahabharat, what characters come in your mind? Ram, Sita, Lakshman, Pandavas, Krishna. But nobody talks of Draupadi, Kunti from Mahabharat, Tara, Mandodari, Devi Ahilya from Ramayan. In fact, nobody talks about birds and animals, Jamvanji, Jatayu. And there are many hidden stories in these scriptures. Some which we don't know, some which got manipulated, and some on which we don't want to talk about. So let's get deep into these hidden gem stories and let's know more about them through our Indian cultural expert, Dr. Vineet Agrawal. Dr. Vineet Agrawal, welcome to Pratipaksh with Hiteshika. First of all, I want to thank you not only from my side, but on behalf of every Indian youth for doing such an incredible work of decoding Hindu mythology. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you so much, Hiteshika, for having me here. And it's really kind of you to appreciate the work, and it actually makes all the effort worthwhile. Thank you so much.
You are an inspiration, as I told you before also. So from yesterday, we all know that Chaitra Navratri has started. And these 9 days are representation of feminine energy. But today we have came from a society which used to think that masculine is the only way where you can actually conquer the world. In fact, today also, we say to women, like, please have your attitude, behavior like in masculine, just in order to succeed. But I think balance of both are required. If masculine is about choosing a path and moving forward in it, feminine is about being happy in whatever you are. So if you can mix it both, moving forward and also being happy at where you are. So this is how you can do. So in our Hindu culture, we have these 5 superwomen who actually balance these masculine and feminine energy and have been inspiration for us because they have gone beyond past and present perspective. So can you please tell us about Panchkanya and also what we can learn from them today?
Most definitely, Hiteshika. First of all, let me say that you put it very well. You know, the balance between masculine and feminine is very important. And it is somehow missing in the modern society. But, maybe it's a little surprising for some people, but the ancient societies were much more balanced than, you know, the so-called modern society is. You know, we had kingdoms where there were only women who were ruling. We had kingdoms where there was actually a matrilineal, an inheritance in place. You find mention of, polyandry in Mahabharata, and not just Draupadi, there are other examples also. And in fact, a lot of people don't understand that women had a very important and a very significant role in our history. And the epics of Mahabharata and Ramayana have some very strong characters. You know, of course, the main characters, the story of the main protagonist is around male characters. But the women are instrumental in bringing about the events that happen. You know, whether you talk about Kaikeyi in Ramayana, you know, Manthara and Kaikeyi were the reason the banishment of Sri Ram happened. You know, had that not occurred, you know, probably Ramayana would not have taken place in that particular form. You know, maybe some other device could have to be found to bring Ram in confrontation with Ravan. Similarly, in the Mahabharata, you see Draupadi is such a important character. You know, she was treated very badly, but she took it in her stride and she did not bow down to the circumstances. Instead, she challenged. She challenged the people. She challenged the king of the land, the emperor, right there in court. And she asked them such pertinent questions that they had no answers to. So imagine, you know, that was the power of these women. And she was instrumental in instigating the Pandavas to take revenge, you know, so to say, for her insult And that is the whole reason the Mahabharata war happened. In fact, you know, when Krishna was going as a Shanti Dut, you know, to Kauravs, and he was suggesting that you give only 5 villages and Pandavas will be happy with that. Draupadi was the one who was unhappy with that because she wanted the revenge, you know, she wanted the Kauravs to face the consequences of their actions. So very, very, very strong women. And the Panch Kanya actually are characters from the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. So there are characters, which is Ahalya, there's Tara, and there is Mandodari, which are from the Ramayana. And there are 2 characters, Draupadi and Kunti, which are from the Mahabharata. So these Panch Kanya are supposed to be, they are believed to be the, you know, epitome of femininity. And in various parameters, it's not just how they handle themselves, it's how they handle the circumstances around them. And if you actually see, you know, Hiteshika, if you read the stories, if you deep dive into their stories, between these 5 of them, they have managed all the difficult circumstances that a woman can encounter. You know, start with Ahalya. Chronologically, probably the oldest example in this list. So Ahalya was the wife of Gautam Rishi. And very interestingly, you know, there's a story that Brahma created her, and because he wanted to create the perfect woman, you know, the perfect woman, everything is in symmetry, and, you know, she is the most attractive personality that, you know, anybody could have seen. And immediately all the gods, you know, were hankering for her, that, you know, she should be my wife. And, you know, so amongst these were the rishis were also there. And Gautam Rishi was one of them. So Brahma says, okay, so we'll decide who actually deserves her by means of a competition. And whoever is able to circumnavigate the globe, you know, the earth. So the first person who is able to do that will be the deserving one, because Ahalya is not any woman, you know, she is the best creation. So you have to prove yourself that, you know, you are really willing to, you know, have her as your spouse. So everybody, you know, rushes on their vahans and stuff. And Gautam Rishi, who's, you know, a slightly older, middle-aged man, but a very kind-hearted soul. And he sees Kamdhenu, you know, the divine cow, Kamdhenu, giving birth to a child, to a calf. And he realizes that, you know, in our scriptures, cow is considered the world, you know. The Sanskrit word for cow is go, which is also a word which also means bhumi or earth. So he circumambulates the cow and the divine calf, and he comes back to Brahma and he says that, I have completed the condition, you know, because as per scriptures, cow is the world, you know. So Brahma recognizes the, you know, the brilliance of the premise. He says that, yes, if not for the physical effort, for the mental effort that you put, you definitely deserve it. And Ahalya is quite happy, you know. It's not as if that, you know, she's sad with the turn of affairs. But, you know, there is a possibility that she had her own sights on someone who was more probably younger or better looking. And Devaraj Indra is actually one of those candidates. So that is the beginning of the story. And, you know, where Indra is frustrated because he's the king of the gods, but he's not able to get Ahalya. And later on in life, you know, when Ahalya and Gautam are happily married and they're living together, and that is when Indra decides to take a chance. And he, you know, everybody knows the story that he takes the form of Gautam Rishi when the Rishi has gone out for prayers in the morning, and he goes into the ashram and he seduces Ahalya. So a lot of people don't realize that, you know, in the Valmiki Ramayana, there are 2 differences from the narrative that most people know. First is that Ahalya recognized that this was not her husband. It was not as if she was a she was taken advantage of. She recognized that this was not her husband, you know, by mannerisms, by the way of talking, by the way he touched her, or, you know, she recognized that this is not my husband. And she also realized that this is a devata, this is a demigod. And she was proud of that, that, you know, that I'm so beautiful that even, you know, leader of the gods is ready to take, change his form to come and be with me. And the second thing is that, you know, when Gautam Rishi comes back and he finds Indra leaving and he's of course angry, you know, and it's not about a husband, you know, being angry on his wife. It's about a partner, feeling betrayed, you know. If you are faithful to your partner, you would expect him from your spouse as well. And that is the anger and the betrayal he felt. And he cursed Indra to get 1,000 vaginas on his body. Imagine, you know, that is the severe curse that he put, that you may be the king of the gods, but because of your lust, you have to roam around like this now, which was later turned on, you know, into 1,000 eyes, you know, but that is why Indra is also called Sahasra Aksh, because he has 1,000 eyes on his body. But in comparison, you know, he was also a little heartbroken with what Ahalya had done. And he cursed her not to turn into a stone, as we are led to believe. You know, in the Valmiki Ramayana, what Gautam says is that, you know, because you're so proud of your beauty, you really will be able to see that beauty and you will turn invisible and you will remain here.
That's why only Shri Ram was able to see Devi Ahilya.
Yes. So she is not turned into stone at all. And you know, in some stories it is shown as if Ram is touching the stone with his feet, and that is when she becomes alive. But that is not there in the Valmiki Ramayana at all. You know, in fact, she's turned invisible. And when Shri Ram enters, you know, that ashram with Lakshman and Vishwamitra, and Vishwamitra tells him the story. And Ram is really sad, you know, he's a very kind and considerate person, you know, and he's just a kid of 15, it's not even 16 years old, you know, when he goes to the forest. And he's touched by that story that, you know, Ahalya has been cursed for so long, she has been living alone. And he actually, it is said that, you know, he touched her feet. And that is when she becomes visible to everyone. So you know, that is how the curse is broken. It's not the way, you know, the toxic masculinity way of narrating the story. It's a very nuanced story. It's a very different story in the original epic. And, you know, this Ahalya and Gautam, they have a son who's called Shatanand. And he is the priest of Janak, Sita's father, Janak. So when they reach Mithila after, you know, this episode, they reach Mithila, and Shatanand is the one who comes running forward, and he drops down at the feet of Vishwamitra and he thanks him that, you know, you have released my mother from the curse. You know, she was trapped like that for eons, you know, for ages. And you have helped release her from that curse. So then the entire backstory is narrated. So Ahalya's story is probably the first example that we see, you know, where there's a woman who is indulging, a married woman who is indulging in extramarital sex. And she is doing it of her own volition. Of course, she didn't go out to find a suitor, but even when she realized, she was okay with it. So that...
And later on the stories, it was manipulated again because of masculinity, that she was innocent and this was not actually happened. And so again, like, this is called equality.
If right.
Man can do it, definitely. Woman can do it.
Exactly. So, you know, this is the first example that we see of an extramarital affair. Not really an affair, but an extramarital episode, you know, which is mentioned in the scriptures. You know, the next examples we see from the Ramayana are of Tara and Mandodari. So Mandodari, everybody knows, was the wife of Ravan, and she was a very nice and genuine person who actually counseled Ravan multiple times, you know, to leave his wicked ways. And, you know, Ravan was a tyrant. A lot of people don't realize this, that, you know, they think of Ravan as a very tragic character, but he was the one who was responsible for Vishnu to take an avatar, you know, because he was such a tyrant and he was creating havoc in the three worlds. That is the reason Lord Vishnu had to take an avatar and come down as Ram. You know, and he was a serial rapist. You know, there are multiple names which have been given in the Valmiki Ramayana itself, where you know he has molested women and he has abducted thousands and thousands of women from all the kingdoms that he has destroyed. And his harem was actually full of abducted women, captured women. And Sita was the last one, you know. Before Sita, there were thousands who had been, mistreated by him. And Mandodari is always cautioning him that, you know, someday you'll have to pay for these actions and, you know, you should not disrespect women like this, etc., etc. He, of course, doesn't listen to her. After Ravan's death, you know, Mandodari could it could have resulted in a civil war because Vibhishan actually betrayed Ravan in a way, right? He joined the enemy. So, you know, there were people in Lanka, there were the Rakshasas or Asuras in Lanka who were still loyal to Ravan. And there was a possibility of a civil war happening. But Mandodari, she decided to marry Vibhishan after Ravan's death, which is again something that
people... Woman.
So she knew, you know, what was required of her as a queen, as the queen of the kingdom, what was required of her to maintain. There had been enough destruction already because of the war, you know, because of lust, which had resulted in that massive war. There had been enough destruction of Lanka, you know. So she did not want things to, you know, go south, you know, again. And she realized that this was probably the best way to maintain peace in the kingdom and, you know, take it in a positive direction. And similarly for Tara, again, a lot of people don't know her. Tara was the wife of Vali. So Tara was the one who was actually cautioning Vali again, just like Mandodari, that, you know, there had been certain incidents where Vali was very short-tempered and he was very, very, he had knee-jerk reactions to most of the things. So she was the one who would always advise him and caution him, about taking such reactions or acting on an impulse. And after Vali's death, Ram realizes that, you know, because Vali had also abducted when he had thrown out Sugriv. You know, there's a whole backstory to why that happened, which we'll not get into right now. Because we're focusing on...
I remember that story.
So, because we're focusing on the female characters right now. So when Vali threw out his brother, his younger brother Sugriv, he kept his wife in his own kingdom. And he said that she's my property now. So that was again, you know, the male ego of Vali, just like Ravan. And so Tara cautioned him again, you know, against that. And later on, when Sri Ram kills Vali and Sugriv is again made the king, I think it's Ram who suggests that, you know, Sugriv should marry Tara. Why? Because, you know, Tara's son, Angad, was the Yuvraj, you know, he was the heir to the kingdom. And again, a civil war could have resulted because there was a faction that was supporting Vali and there was a faction who was supporting Sugriv. And Sugriv had Hanuman with him, you know, who could defeat Hanuman. So they were very strong, powerful factions and it could have resulted in a civil war in Kishkindha. And Tara married Sugriv and Sri Ram actually extracted a promise out of Sugriv that Tara's son Angad would remain the heir to the kingdom. So it was a very beautiful, diplomatic move where there is no insult to the woman. She remains the queen and her son remains the heir to the kingdom. And how these two women managed those situations around them, you know, they did not really have a lot of say in the way things were happening. But they could have said no, or they could have, left the kingdom and gone somewhere else. Mandodari was the daughter of Maya Danav, you know, he's the architect of the Asuras. So she did not have any reason to stay in Lanka. She could have easily gone back to her father's house. But she took that conscious decision in the interest of her kingdom. You know, she decided to stay in Lanka and be with Vibhishan. Similarly, Tara, you know, decided to be with Sugriv. Even though, you know, he was the reason that her husband was killed. But she decided to be with Sugriv. probably because of the future of her child, you know, of her son. Mm. And she even afterwards, she was very, very, her business acumen was very sharp, as in, you know, the practical aspects of life. So when Sugriv becomes king, he, for a year almost, he forgets everything about finding Sita. You know, for months together, he's just enjoying being the king. And then monsoon happens and all that. And then Lakshman is suddenly very angry. He's like, what is he doing? You know, he has not helped us. We have helped him gain the kingdom back, but he has not helped us at all, you know. And that's when he's very angry and he goes and confronts Sugriv.
Mm.
And that is when Tara comes into the picture again and Tara calms him down.
Mm.
So see, these women are very strong, you know. She, imagine she is able to calm down Lakshman, you know.
Lakshman Nagdev. So one question in this, if today also if any woman take these kinds of actions, they are going to be shamed by society. So at that time, were they shamed or society were treating equally at that time, both men and women? What was the situation at that time? Because as the ages go, the main script got manipulated just to show that a woman fits in this parameter only, women are very innocent and something like that. But and today, if that is growing, but still there's a shame. So were they shamed? Were they equally treated? What actually happened?
No, definitely not. Definitely they were not shamed. In fact, you know, the episode of Agni Pariksha that a lot of people, you know, are very, they find it very disturbing. But, you know, again, because people don't read the Valmiki Ramayana. So in the Valmiki Ramayana, Ram does not ask Sita to give an Agni Pariksha. He does not. Mm-hmm. Ram says that, you know, and, you know, it's very beautiful. Ram is being very open-minded, where he's saying that, you know, you have lived in one of the most prosperous kingdoms for a year. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you want now. I have performed my duty as a husband to rescue you. Okay. Mm. But now if you want to stay here, it is your call. I am not demanding you to come with me because I rescued you. So Sita is hurt by that. You know, she says that how can you even think I will leave you and, you know, stay here. And she herself asks Lakshman to create that fire. And, you know, she herself walks into the fire. No one asks her to give the Agni Pariksha. She does it herself. So, and, you know, the people around are aghast at that, you know. They are like, and the gods come down, you know, to convince Ram that, you know, you have to take her back. And Ram says, I know, I have full faith in her. But, you know, for the sake of the thousands of people who will be having her as their queen, you know, this was required. He did not ask her to do it.
Hmm.
Ram himself had proven his worth to become the king. You know, he fought the enemies. He destroyed the enemies. He rescued his wife. He proved his worth, you know, by his actions. And this was the time, this was the moment when Sita also had to prove her worth to be the queen of Ayodhya. And she did it herself. So women were not shamed at all. You know, the society was very different. In fact, you know, except for the episode of Draupadi's disrobing, you do not find, even in the Mahabharata, you do not find women being shamed anywhere. And in
fact, except in the court when it happened with
that's what I'm saying. You know, except for that disrobing of Draupadi, you know, there is no way, no other episode you'll ever find in the Mahabharata or the Ramayana where women were shamed, you know, for being women or for making choices that they that men didn't like, you know. In fact, there are other examples of from the epics itself where women were so strong. Kaikeyi, you know, for example, Kaikeyi went to the war with Dashrath. She saved life. So, you know, she demanded that, you know, Dashrath, had it been a male-dominated society, Dashrath could have easily said no, that forget it, I'm not giving you these boons. But the entire, very fact that Dashrath gave into the boons that he had to his wife shows that women were not considered inferior. You know, he had given his vachan to his wife, and he had to respect that. So there are various examples where you see women are very, very strong.
Wow, that's amazing. And if we are talking about these strong women, now I want to talk on Kali, the who is full of energy. And once you said that Kali has been the character which has been way, way much misunderstood in the history. And with the Kali comes Tantra. Even during these Navratri, in my colony only, I can see in Chauraha some kind of activities going on, like black magic activities going on. You can see sindoor, or I can see any kind of meat there. So what is actually happening? Is it related with Kali? And people also think that through Tantra, they can pass their sufferings or their any bad sufferings if they are. Through Tantra, they can pass it. If that can actually happen, then how karma works? If we can just pass our bad sufferings to others. So many questions. You can go one by one.
So, you know, Hiteshika, first of all, Kali, I mentioned it in one of the podcasts that she was very misunderstood because, you know, primarily in the West, they were exposed to Kali as, through movies like Sindbad, and then there was the Indiana Jones movies where, you know, there are Kali worshippers who are, committing atrocities, etc. It's a very, very negative and incorrect portrayal of Kali in the Western movies. And because of that, a lot of people got confused. And Kali has been shown as somewhat of a demon, you know, in these movies. Which is exactly the opposite, because Kali had emerged to take care of the demons whom the gods could not destroy. So she is fierce and she's so scary because she needs to scare the daylights out of the demons themselves, you know. Mm-hmm. And she is the she's the ultimate pinnacle of feminism in ancient India, where, you know, you see her standing on the body of her husband, you know, and most of the Dash Mahavidyas, which are different manifestations of Kali, you would always see that, either the throne or is made up of the gods and the goddess is sitting on top of it. Mm-hmm. So it shows the female power, it shows the feminine aspect being more powerful than the male gods. And the entire story of Kali and Durga itself shows that, you know, women can do what even men find it difficult to do, you know. Mm-hmm. And so when it comes to dark magic, I would say it's a misuse of the powers that you get while performing worship of the Dash Mahavidyas. So Dash Mahavidyas are believed to give you certain siddhis. And through the use of the five M's, which are not really allowed in the regular worship, you know, they are the five M's of Tantra, where, you know, you can utilize these substances for worshipping in Tantra. And using these, it is said that there's a shorter method to reach God. This is a shorter method to attain those siddhis. But a lot of people do this for personal benefit. When you're talking about, you know, them sacrificing something or trying to pass on their bad luck to someone else, it can never be postponed forever. Your fate, your destiny will catch up with you sooner or later. If you manage to postpone it now, it will catch up in the future. That is it. It will happen, you know. So in fact, in my story, in the second book that I have written on Parshuramji, there is a boon, you know, which was given, you know, there's a potion which is made by a rishi, and it's given to two women to have children. And one of them is Vishwamitra and the second one is Parshuram. Mm. But Parshuram is actually one generation further away from the boon, because the lady who had received that potion, she said, no, I do not want a violent child. I do not want a child with Kshatriya tendencies. Mm. And so her husband, being an accomplished rishi, he said, okay, this can be postponed only by one generation, but it will come to pass. Your husband may not be, violent or turn into a Kshatriya warrior, but his son will definitely turn into one. So that is what happens with destiny, that what is written in, this is your karma that's deciding your destiny. Your previous karma decides your destiny, your present, your present fate, and your present karma decides your future. So we, so when we are performing these actions, when we are causing trouble to other people, that is also generating bad karma for us. So you may get rid of that, you know, a bad patch of time, but you are amplifying it by performing these actions. You're passing it on to somebody, causing distress to someone else, that will also backfire ultimately. So you'll receive this, plus that was destined for you any which ways, you know, in the future. So it's a no-brainer. You should not, you know, your misery is yours to bear. It's yours to endure, and you emerge stronger from it. You know, if you ever try to do bad to others through these means, you know, it will backfire. It will come back to haunt you sooner or later, whether in this life or in the next life. So that is the whole aspect of black magic, which is not what the scriptures recommend. You know, it is not for attaining that purpose. It's a different way to reach God, but people get sidetracked.
How in Navratri these things start increasing? Is it related to Kali only, or this time is very precious? That's why all these just are getting very fastly, or we get the result very fast. How is it happening these 9 days? I can really see daily in my colony only. I can see it daily, on a daily basis. There are some things going on and on. And last time I saw in Sharad Navratri, and now in this Navratri.
So see, Navratri actually comes 4 times in a year, okay? And it is in different seasons. And these 9 nights are actually dedicated to the goddess, because goddess is Prakriti. And when we talk about seasons, that is Prakriti, right? It's changing its form. You know, nature is changing its form. So these 9 days in each season, we have 4 main seasons. So, you know, we have, so this Chaitra Navratri comes in spring. Spring or summer, you can say. And you know, then you have the Gupta Navratri, 2 Gupta Navratris, which is in Ashar, which is monsoon. And then you have the Sharad Navratri, which is the more better known one. And then you have in winters, you have the Magh Gupta Navratri. So 4 times in 4 seasons, whenever nature is changing, you know, that is this 9 day period is dedicated to nature, basically. And if you see the different forms of the Navadurga that we worship during these times, they're also very closely connected to nature, you know, because we start with, you know, Shailputri, the first form of Navadurga, first form of Ma Durga, which is worshipped on the first day of Navratri, is of Shailputri. And Shail means mountains. So she's the daughter of the mountains. So, you know, it's basically Parvati, but she's called the daughter of the mountains. And she, so, you know, right from the first form, we are made aware that she is the daughter of nature. You know, mountains are our environment. And that is why, you know, you you are encouraged to worship nature or Prakriti or Devi, you know, in these 9 days. And it is supposed to keep you healthy. The fasting, of course, you know, in a scientific way, you can understand, it's sort of a detox for your body. Like every season you spend 9 days fasting, you know, so that's 4 times in a year. You fast for 9 days and you get, your body gets a good break, you know, where you're having only fresh fruits, or you're having milk products, you're avoiding spices, you're avoiding fried. Of course, a lot of people eat fried in the fast, which is not supposed to be done. But ideally, you have to take, you know, the minimum quantity of food which is required. Your entire digestive system gets a break, you know. Your desire for eating something, you know, spicy, for drinks, for intoxication, everything, you know, you get a break. Your brain, your body, everything gets a break. You know, in these 9 days, and it breaks the habit, actually. So it's a very healthy thing to do. And it is basically a recognition that nature is changing and we have to pray to the goddess. And these 9 days in every season are considered very auspicious for goddess worship.
And that's why when we do dandiyats for like making our body move and also to have those happy emotions.
Yes.
And now when we are, you were talking about earth, nature, is it somehow related to tamas, rajas and satas? We say savas or satas, I'm not sure.
Yeah, so it is not really related to the three gunas here, but the way of worship can be related to it, as in the sattvic mode of worship is where, you know, we worship Navdurga, you do fasting and you do the regular puja and bhajan kirtan and, you know, Durga stuti, etc. The tamasic way is the tantric way of doing it. So, you know, so we are offering meat or intoxicants to the gods, the Bali concept, all that is the tamasic way of worship. So rajasic is again there, you know, rajasic way is, you know, you are having a grand party. You're not fasting. You are offering food. You're preparing, you know, delicious things for God. You're offering to God as prasad and then you're consuming it. So depending on the gunas, you know, your sattvic or rajasic or tamasic gunas, you can have a different way of worshipping the goddess.
Okay, got it. Now I want to ask my personal favorite question. So I have grown up from childhood watching Ramanand Sagar, Ramayan, V.R. Chopra's Vishnu Puran, and in which animals or birds have been depicted as superpowers. So if we talk about in Ramayan, if we talk about Jamvanji, who was bear, so he was considered as very wise and old. Now, if we talk about Jatayu, was eagle who tried to save Sita Mata from Ravan. Then in Samudra Manthan, we have in Vishnu Puran, we have Pakshiraj, whom Vishnuji ordered to cut Mandar tree and bring it to Samudra. So they have been shown or they have been depicted as someone very highly powered in terms of spiritual, mentally, physically. So what actually happened? As we humans also involved, we also start losing our consciousness. So still we can go to that higher level of consciousness, not that much, but we can attend some level to Dhyan Sadhana. Can animals or bird also attend that higher level of consciousness, or that has been just the story? What actually happened?
Right. So I think, Hiteshika, you know, these are not just ordinary animals or birds, you know, they are semi-divine beings. You know, they are not, you know, when we talk about Nagas, we are not really talking about the snakes, you know, we are talking about serpentine beings, you know. And I feel, you know, it's probably it's difficult to explain, you know, in a scientific way, but, you know, probably if you imagine, we humans have evolved from mammals, right, from apes. So imagine if there was a species, you know, like the Neanderthal man, or there was, you know, some such species which was different from humans, you know, from Homo sapiens, which also evolved simultaneously or probably before us, you know, and they were more powerful than us. They were stronger. They were ape-like, you know, they were more hairy, and, you know, their faces were also very different from how modern humans look. So those could have been the Vanars. Right. So there are different species which could have been possible. And, you know, Nags and the Garuds, the Suparnas, etc., they are not supposed to actually reside on Earth. You know, they have their own lokas. So Patal Lok, there is a Nag Lok, you know. So, you know, it's actually delving into science fiction that, you know, it could be possible that there was a race which evolved from the reptiles, you know. So, you know, instead of mammals, we humans became the predominant species on Earth. But on other planets, if there is life, it is not necessary that the same, you know, we always see Martians looking so different in science fiction and all that. So evolution would occur differently. So there could be lokas, you know, where life evolved from reptiles and, you know, they are semi-reptile and, you know, semi, you know, humanoid, you know, in their looks. They could be Suparnas, you know, where evolution could have happened from birds. And they have, you know, bigger bodies, stronger bodies, but they also retained wings. So it's very difficult to say, but I like to feel, you know, that probably these are beings that actually exist in a different planet or different, you know, loka realm. And as far as consciousness is concerned, you know, it is said that human form on earth, at least, is the human form that is the most suitable for realizing the spiritual you know, requirements which we all should be doing, you know, the spiritual journey that we should be following. And our brains, our intellect is the perfectly suited of all the species that are there on this planet to understand these concepts, to ask these questions, first of all. You know, animals, you see, are very happy doing what they're doing. They just, wherever you give them food, they're happy. You know, you keep them as pets, they're happy in any situation, you know, and they don't really have any existential questions, you know. Mm-hmm. It is only humans who have the intellect to ask these questions and find answers. So at least on earth, you know, humans are considered the, and that is why our scriptures also say that, you know, even devas and asuras, they crave to be born as a human, because the kind of access you get as a human, you know, the struggles that you face, they make you realize the reality faster than if you are in a devlok, you know, where you're surrounded by luxuries. When you're living a comfortable life, you don't think of God so much, right? It's only when adversity strikes that you start asking questions and you start thinking about spirituality. As long as you're living a very comfortable life, nobody bothers about God or spirituality. So it is said that human form is the best suited form, and that is why the scriptures advise that you should not waste this opportunity. You have to realize what a boon you have received for being born as a human. And again, you know, even as a human, you see a lot of people suffering. You know, somebody could be physically handicapped, somebody could be born in a very poor household, somebody could be born in a war-torn country, you know, where the very survival is a question, you know. So if we are born in a family where we have the basic comforts sorted, and we are still squandering that opportunity to know more, you know, it's a waste of this life. So humans, I would say, you know, we are the best possible bet that God has placed on this soul, which is inside the body, to at least strive for salvation.
In this, as you were talking of evolution, I remember, in fact, Vishnuji take 10 avatars in which he also evolved. Like, the first avatar was Matsya avatar, where it was before Darwin theory. Vishnuji cleared that this was how Earth was. Like, first we have Matsya avatar, where it was fish. But then we have started having life both in earth and water, then turtle. Then he became Vara. Then he is Narsinha, we're half human, half animal.
Exactly.
And then I think when Parshuram also happened, so Parshuram was not emotionally stable. So that's why after that we have Ramji. Yes. And then he was peaceful man, but then Krishna came and he teaches us how to love, how to make love. And then Buddha is also considered as a avatar. So he was a very wise person. Now, about talking about 10th avatar, I hope we are not running out of time.
That's okay.
So what this 10th avatar will be of? So as Earth was evolving, that's how Vishnuji took avatar. So if we talk about today we are, it seems like we are going very much towards technology. So is 10th avatar going to be like in that field only, or it's going to be different, the Kalki avatar?
I think it's anybody's guess. You know, the scriptures just mention that, you know, when would the avatar come? You know, they mention some details about, you know, the astrological conjunctions that would be there. A little bit about, you know, the place where he will be born, which is called Shambhala. And then again, you know, they give the name of his father, etc. So some details are given, but, and is also mentioned that he will rid the world of evil kings and tyranny, riding his horse, Devdutt. So you know, there's some details given. Now, in what form exactly God will come, that is very difficult to say. It could be a, you know, how we see the android robots, you know, in sci-fi. It could be a more mechanical form. That could be the next step of evolution for humans, for all we know, you know, that humans sync with the machines, with the artificial intelligence, and to enhance our own abilities. So it could be a very futuristic form, you know, for all you know. And it is very difficult to say, but I hope it is something more exciting than just a man riding a horse. Just one point I wanted to add was that, you know, we were talking about the Panchkanya, and we probably skipped Kunti. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I also want to highlight one aspect from her life, from Kunti's life, that, you know, she was a queen, right? Her husband was the king. Pandu was the king. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, when she was, when Pandu decides to take sannyas, you know, because of the curse on him, she has to follow her husband, right? She was a queen. Why did she have to go? But she decided to follow her husband. And again, you know, even in the Vanvas, even in the forest, you know, they were not able to have children because of the curse that Pandu had received. Mm-hmm. That if he indulged in copulation, you know, he would die. Mm-hmm. So Kunti actually had the boon which was given to her by Durvasa Rishi, and she still managed to get heirs for her husband, you know. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, this is a very interesting example of a woman siring children, not through her husband, but mm-hmm. through divine beings, you know. So this is very similar to the concept of immaculate conception that you have you know, in Christianity, where Jesus was born to a virgin Mary. And so Kunti also, you know, invoked these gods through the mantras, and she was blessed with children. But again, you see how well she cared for not just her own children, but also the sons of her rival, which was Mati, you know, the other wife of Pandu. She also gave birth to two children using the same mantra that Kunti gave her. You know, so she was not jealous of her co-wife, you know, and she in fact took very good care of Nakul and Sahadev. In fact, in the entire Mahabharata, you see, she was the stepmother, but she is unlike any stepmother you see depictions, you know, in movies or books. She cared so much for Nakul and Sahadev that, you know, in the forest when the Pandavas are in exile with Draupadi. You know, there's this whole episode of where Yamaraj comes to test the Pandavas. And, you know, there's a whole episode called Yaksh Prashna, where Yudhishthir is asked a lot of questions by Yamaraj.
I remember.
Right. So there, you know, all the Pandavas are lying almost dead, you know, after drinking poison water. And the Yaksh, who's actually Yamaraj, and he asks Yudhishthir that if I am to revive, you know, one of your brothers, who would it be? And Yudhishthir says that I am alive. I am able to answer your question. So you have spared my life. I am alive. So one of the sons of Kunti is alive. You know, so I want one of the sons of Madri to be revived, because my mother loves them a lot, and she will never forgive me if I ask, you know, for her own son to be revived. So, you know, that shows how much, how well, you know, these women actually performed their roles in the society. It was not just, she could have been bitter because, you know, Madri was responsible for Pandu's death in the end, you know, when they, in a moment of weakness, they decide to copulate and that's when they die, you know. So she could have been bitter with Madri or her children, but she didn't let her cloud her judgment, you know, regarding the raising of her sons. Yes. So Kunti, and again, you know, when you see the entire episode of Draupadi being shared with the brothers, with the Pandavas, it was Kunti who said it, that, you know, whatever you brought, you share amongst yourself. Don't you think, you know, she could have just easily said, no, don't do it. You know, when she realized that it was not some Dan, it was a woman that we're talking about. But imagine, you know, she knew that one woman could create rivalries in brothers. You know, there were historical episodes, you know, there were stories, many stories where one woman had caused rivalry between brothers. There are stories of some asuras, there are stories of some other beings, divine beings, where this has happened. And she knew the power that Draupadi's beauty had. And she knew she would be able to bind all the brothers together. So that was the you know, level of thought that had gone into that decision of continuing with, you know, the polyandrous arrangement. And even in that, a lot of people don't realize that Draupadi had very fixed rules. You know, she had very fixed rules. She was supposed to be with one brother for the whole year.
Mm.
You know, she fixed the rules. She decided that I will be with one brother for this year and no one else could come near her in that duration. Mm. And Arjun had once entered that chamber where Draupadi was with Yudhishthira because his weapons were there and he was exiled for that. You know, and that is the time when he roamed around India and he prayed to the gods and he, you know, got access to the divine weapons and all that. But there were very strict rules that Draupadi had put in place. So, you know, these women were very much in control of their lives, of their surroundings and the men around them. So I would say, you know, just to wrap it up, because we started with Panchkanya, we wrap it up with this realization that women in the ancient times were much more stronger than we give them credit for. Yeah. And, you know, it's high time the modern society also learns, you know, from our scriptures, and it realizes the importance that women have in the society, in the continuation of the society, and in the maintenance of a civilized world. Hmm. So, yeah, I would wrap up there.
Just last one question. As you were saying that from Satyug till Treta Yug, after Treta Yug, Dwapar Yug, we can see that people were very wise. And we think that today we are open-minded, but they were way open-minded and wise and intellectual. And in fact, technically also, they were more sound.
Yes.
What actually happened through these yugs that we changed a lot? That in Satyug, people were very nice. There was no any kind of negative emotion like anger or jealousy. Then Treta Yug comes where Ramji came. And then there we have this divination of Brahmin, Kshatriya. But still, there was some kind of negative emotion, but still people were nice. Then comes Dwapar Yug, where Krishna has to take place and where these things start increasing. But still, people... there was some few things left of goodness or the mind or the intellectual or the open heart and open-minded. Then we have this Kali Yuga. So what actually happened? Was there any change in nature or what was actually happening?
Of course. We see that happening, you know, the human intellect, we feel that, you know, we are advancing a lot, but you know, the scriptures say that human intellect actually goes down with each yuga. You know, the lives of humans go down, the human intellect is actually lesser than what it was in the previous yugas. And, you know, it is actually interesting to see that the morality, level of morality in the society is also going down. You know, in the Kali Yuga, we see it happening all around us. You know, there are atrocious cases that come to light, you know, which you can never imagine. Mm. And the amount of degradation that society has seen in Kali Yuga, you know, that is a result of, so it is said that, you know, Kali is the demon. You know, we talk about Shaitan in Islam, or, you know, the Satan in Christianity. Mm. A lot of people feel that, you know, there is no similar counterpart in Hinduism, but that's not true. Kali is the demon, which is very similar to devil, you know, of Western religions.
Mm.
Kali is supposed to influence people and act. And this is the time of Kali. This yuga is ruled by Kali. Mm. So that is why he's very powerful. And, you know, you get all these events that are happening. And, you know, so I would say it's a natural progression of the yugas where, you know, the life becomes lesser, the dharma becomes more fragmented. Mm. And it is said that, you know, in the Satyug, dharma is like a bull with four legs. And with each successive age or yug, you know, the one of the legs is broken. And in fact, there's a story in the Mahabharata of Parikshit, who's the grandson of Pandavas, you know, who takes over the empire after the Pandavas leave. And he actually encounters the Kali Purush, you know, breaking the legs of a bull. And he goes there and he stops him. And there is just one leg left, you know, so of that bull to stand on. And it is kneeling down otherwise, you know. So Parikshit stops him and he decides to behead the Kali Purush. And Kali says, but that's not fair. You know, I have been given this age. So you cannot do that. You cannot kill me. And Parikshit says, okay, you will stay in places, you know, where there is, you cannot be everywhere. You will be limited to places where there is illicit, you know, where there's gambling, where there's illicit sex, where there's alcohol, etc. So, you know, you are limited to those places. Money, you know, you can reside in money. So that is why you see most of the things, most of the bad things that happen in the world today happen in these four respects only. It's either a fight for money, for property, for women, for, you know, power. So these are the things where Kali is supposed to reside. And we can still counter the progression of Kali by abstaining from these activities. So that is the logic which is given in the scriptures.
And I think these all are again solution for the youth to how to be safe from the damned Kali.
Yes.
If you can stay away from that.
Yes.
And any more tip you would like to give youth to how to live in this Kali Yuga?
You know, I really don't like to preach, you know, so it is to each person, you know, his journey is different and everybody has to live it in their own way. But I would say, you know, be mindful of the results of your actions. The law of karma is very real. And, you know, if you're just mindful of the activities that you're doing, that itself is enough, you know, for this life, because it is not easy for everyone to get that realization that we have to follow a spiritual journey. Hmm. But what is important for everyone to realize is that we have to be a good human being, you know, just not just for ourselves, not just for our own lives, for our families, for the society, for the whole world to survive. We see so many events happening in the world, you know, wars happening who would have expected a war? We would see a war in 2022, you know. So there's so many things that are happening because of ambition, greed, power, you know, and you see things happening in your own lives. You know, you see, you know, the politics becomes dirty. You see a lot of things happening. And people don't realize that whatever, every single thing that they're doing will have consequences, whether it is good or bad. So if everybody becomes mindful of just that fact, that the law of karma is real, and you can see it, you know, in your own life, you can see it and you can realize that, yes, it does happen. And if we are all just mindful of that, I think that is good enough.
Thank you so much again, Dr. Vinita.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a very nice conversation for me as well. So thanks for following up, and thanks for arranging this.